we go on to something that is very far from torture and is full of pleasure, and that is the subject of books. And we raise the question, if you've ever loved a book so much while you're reading it, that you can't put it down, but at the same time you don't want it to end. And that's where we asked our three guests to address within this world of books. Writer and director Peter Sheridan, the author Joseph O'Connor, and Sinead Moriarty, and have all joined us to tell us about the books they wanted to last forever. Well, we may give endings away here, so I'll just give you a warning on that. Joseph O'Connor, welcome back to the programme.
Thank you very much, Marianne.
I'm completely biased because I like the book you chose.
Yes, well, the first thing I would say is very, very difficult. I had a lot of hours of pleasurable wondering how I could possibly get this down to one. And I had a couple. I mean, Great Expectations by Dickens, a novel that I read when I was 14 or 15, which I still love. But I remember it was the first time I was really conscious of the end of a book. It has the most beautiful finishing sentence. I took her hand in mine and we went out of the ruined place. And as the morning mists had risen long ago when I first left the forge, so the evening mists were rising now. And in all the broad expanse of tranquil light they showed to me, I saw no shadow of another parting from her. And I just thought, wow. So there's that.
You must tell them what the book is first.
Great Expectations, was. But the book that I finally really had no choice other than to pick is J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye, published first in 1951 and a perennial bestseller ever since. For people who haven't read it, it's the story of a 17-year-old boy, Holden Caulfield. He is in a boarding school in Pennsylvania. He gets into trouble and he's sent home to Manhattan, where he lives with his parents. But
Are nice people.
They're very nice, yeah. But he decides not to go home. He has scraped together a few dollars. He goes to hang out in Manhattan, gets a room in a flop house, and tries to get people to serve him drink, and tries to meet young ones in cocktail bars, and just makes a complete mess of everything. But he is such a funny, warm, smart, vulnerable, vivid character. I suppose the fact that I was 17 myself when I first read it must have had something to do with it.
Yeah, you could imagine yourself into that.
Well, this is the very interesting thing, and I'm sure my colleagues on the panel feel the same. I think there's a particular pleasure when you encounter a book or a band where you feel people are speaking for you. You know, C.S. Lewis said, "We read to know we are not alone." And when I first encountered The Catcher, it certainly had that, you know, notion that this kid who is, as I say, sparky and sardonic and full of lip, to paraphrase the opening of the book, he says, "I suppose you'd like me to give you, you know, where I was born and where my parents came from and all that David Copperfield crap, but I'm not going to." And you're reading this as a kid who actually likes Dickens, as I just said, but you think, wow, like he's demolishing the whole tradition of the novel in the opening four or five lines of the book. So it was like how I felt when I first heard the Boomtown Rats or the Sex Pistols. And the other reason, I suppose, I love the book is that it's really the book that made me want to be a writer myself. I mean, the context at the time, I was reading a lot and there were books in the house and my parents loved reading. But I can remember the actual moment of turning the last page of The Catcher in the Rye. I could probably come up with the date if I thought about it carefully enough. I got to that ending, I turned the last page and I said, right, that's what I would like to do with my life. So it was a hugely powerful book for me. Absolutely. Yeah. And I have gone back to it every 3 or 4 years.
Well, I've read that with interest. I thought, I'm not a rereader. Maybe I should myself, because I would think I was about that age when I read it first, about 16 or 17. Sinead, which one did you pick?
Yes, well, I've picked one
that reminded me of a book that I loved. I have kind of loosely compared this to Kill a Mockingbird, which I know is high praise indeed.
It most certainly is,
which is one of my favourite books as a child. But my book is Elizabeth Winthrop's The Mercy Seat. And I was just saying to Joe and Peter outside, I don't think it's getting enough traction. It's absolutely beautiful. It's the story of, it's set in 1943 in Louisiana in the really, really intense heat. You actually almost start sweating when you're reading the book. It's so evocative. And this young black man is on death row and they are delivering the electric chair to Louisiana to kill him. And the whole book takes place on the evening of that that event, and the story is told through nine people's different points of view. You've got the priest who thinks he's innocent, and the whole thing about the book is we're not sure if he is actually guilty at all. He's been charged with raping a white girl who then commits suicide, but it turns out she was actually his girlfriend. So, and they got caught in flagrante by her father, so then he accused him of rape. So the whole book takes place in lots of different points of view. Some people think he's guilty, some people don't, and he speaks for himself as well. His voice comes into it. And it's just this incredibly beautiful, compelling, evocative, moving, heartbreaking, and very tense, because it's all building up to this moment. And is he going to be killed or is he not? And I won't ruin the end, but the end is quite surprising. And it was very loosely based on a real case of a guy called Willie Jones, who was accused of rape back when he was 16 years old, and something kind of extraordinary happened that night as well. So it's the most beautiful book. And, you know, it's quite brave for, you know, a young white woman to take on this story, as some of the reviewers have said.
How did you find it?
It's just exceptional. It's quite a short book, actually, and each person's voice might just be like a page or two.
Yeah.
But I couldn't put it down. Like, it's the most beautiful book. I couldn't recommend it more. Please treat yourself. And as I said, like, it reminded me of To Kill a Mockingbird, which is one of my favourite books, and I don't say that lightly. So I think it's beautiful, and I think more people need to read it.
And you didn't want it to end?
I didn't want it to end. I actually started rereading it immediately, and I'm not a rereader.
Right.
So, yeah.
Peter?
I chose a book I read recently. I could have gone back to books that had a huge influence on me when I was younger, but I decided to just pick something that really whacked me. And this book, Educated by Tara Westover, is an absolute knockout of a book. It's set in Idaho amongst a fundamentalist Mormon family. The dad is a very difficult man who believes that the world is coming to an end. He talks about end of days all the time. He reads his Bible every night. So it's a family story, a growing up in a family story. That's what it appears to be about. And then as the book progresses, the author starts to tell us what's really going on in this family. The mum is, for example, is a herbalist and a midwife. So there's lovely warmth and richness and, you know, all of that. But suddenly the story starts to unfold that there's things going on in this family that are very, very dodgy altogether. And some of it, I think, is actually left unsaid as well, which is always an interesting experience to have with a book, that you're not being told the whole story, but right, it's inferred, it's implied. The second half of the book becomes about the author's journey to get an education. Because by age of 15, she's never been to school. They're homeschooled because they're fundamentalist Mormons.
Yeah.
The book begins, they're talking about, there was a very famous thing in a place called Ruby Ridge in America where the FBI surrounded a cabin where they believed that people were stockpiling weapons. And it lasted, the siege lasted, I think, for about 2 weeks, and a number of people were killed. So that's set right up at the beginning of this. The father is talking about, you know, that Ruby Ridge is going to end up bad, you know. The Zionist government, he keeps talking about this Zionist government, and everybody in government in America is against the Mormons and against the fundamentalists, and he believes that the world's going to end on the 1st of January 2000,
right,
at the turnover into that year.
Yeah.
So that's what's going on there. But this girl, who doesn't have a birth certificate, doesn't know what day she was born on. So when she applies to go to school, for example, they have to start getting on the phone and trying to find out when she was born. Her parents don't know what day she was born. So it's kind of crazy stuff. And then she starts to get an education. Aged about 17. She goes to Brigham Young University, where I taught myself one time for 10 days because I knew a professor there who wanted me to give a class on Irish drama. So she's in Brigham Young University, which is a Mormon university in Utah. And there's an amazing scene in the book where on one of her first days in school, she puts her hand up and she asks what the word on the board means.
She had heard other students asking
The teacher wrote this word on the board.
Okay.
And she didn't know what it was or what it meant. So she put her hand up and she said, I don't know what that word means. Now, the author brilliantly doesn't tell you what the word is for another three chapters. So you're trying to think, what word is she referring to here? Is it a word to do with a sexual connotation? What is the word? So finally, she reveals that the word is Holocaust. She didn't know what the Holocaust was. And the kids in the class thought it was an anti-Semitic thing, that she was saying the Holocaust never took place.
Oh, denier.
Therefore, why are we talking about a Holocaust when the Holocaust... And that's what her father would have believed. Her father would have actually believed that that was a construct that wasn't true.
She had never heard the word.
She had never heard the word. So then the book becomes about what the purpose of education is. So from age 17 on, this girl is starting to come to grips with what it means to get knowledge that she never had before. And it's heart-stopping stuff. You're kind of rooting for her. You want her to succeed because she has no background in education. But what she does have is great emotional maturity and a great ability to ask really difficult questions about herself, her family. Her education then starts to make her feel that she has to tell the truth about what's going on in this family. I mean, it's one of the great books of modern times. And
they're fighting words.
But it really is, because, you know, I went to school, you know, back in the 50s. I was the only kid from my class who went on to do a Leaving Cert. So I went to school at a time and in a place where there wasn't much value on education in the community that I lived in. Yet my parents totally believed in education. So my heart is with this character. I know kind of what that journey is about, where you sort of find yourself, you know, in a university setting, wanting to tell stories about where you come from, wanting to tell stories about what your experience of life is. So education isn't really about rote learning.
Right.
Education is about emotional maturity, and this girl is on an emotional journey that's absolutely compelling.
Is it kind of on the style of Elegy, Hillbilly?
They're a family. On the one hand, like, the father runs a junkyard, you know, and the kids all work in the junkyard.
But there's no drugs around like
that. No, but he puts them in extreme danger. He puts the kids in extreme danger.
Right. Okay.
You know, and they're all the time fighting to be safe. It's just extraordinary.
It's brilliant, actually. I chose it for the Easton's Book Club. I loved it so much. So that was another of my choices. Educated, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Because that's you go through their book club.
Yeah, actually, I myself and Rick run a book club for Easton. So we choose every season, we choose 8 books. He chooses 4, I choose 4. And actually, that's how I came across The Mercy Seat. So it's Sinead and Rick's must reads. And I chose Educated and The Mercy Seat last year as 2 of my choices. So I completely agree.
Right.
The Educated is phenomenal.
Listen, you guys that do all this writing, do you know the end of a book before you start?
I have to, I must say. I learned the painful way that is essential for me. There's a piece about Anna McCarrick in the Irish Times this morning, and I have very happy memories generally of being at Anna McCarrick, but one terrible one. It's the first time I went. I was living in London. I had this book that was on the go. It was just getting longer and longer and longer. 120, 130, 150,000 words. The late Bernard Loughlin, God be good to him, allowed me to come to Anna McCarrick for 3 weeks, and I thought, right, I'm going to find the ending of this book. So every day I wrote another 5,000, another 10,000. The 3 weeks went by. The day before I was supposed to go back, there's a lake at Anna McCarrick, and in those days, there are fewer rules about health and safety. They would allow the artists to row out into the middle of the lake. So I thought, I'm going out into the middle of the lake. I'm not coming back until I have the ending of the book. So I rowed out to the middle of the lake and I lifted up the oars. I smoked a lot in those days. I remember smoking my way through the 20 cigarettes as the boat just revolved in the lake. And I had, Marion, an epiphany, which is, this book has no ending. And what you've got to do is row back in and trudge back up to the house and get this 200,000 word baggy monster and throw it in the bin and start all over again.
Oh, so I
have never since begun something that I don't have some sense of the destination. I mean, it can change in the course of things, but I would have to have some notion of where I'm going.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I have to know where I'm going, because I have made that mistake and ended up down cul-de-sacs and dead ends, and it's just, it is very painful.
As I was reading the briefs, I thought, what a difficult bunch of people you are, and hatchet jobs that you can do on people. Like, if you start a book, if it doesn't do the business straight away, how long do you give
it? I just have a 30-page rule. I have a 30-page rule. If I'm not engaged by the book by page 30, I stop reading. And if I go to the cinema and I'm not engaged by the film, I'm asleep usually after 20 minutes. I can sleep anywhere, Marion.
God,
I can sleep at the theatre. I can sleep in the cinema. I can sleep on plane, whatever. But I just, there are certain things, and when, if I'm not connected, if they don't connect to me, I simply switch off.
I'd be the same, I must say. Maybe a little bit more than 30. But I sort of feel there's a lot of really great novels in the world that I haven't read yet, and I'm not going to waste time on stuff that doesn't engage me. I think it's my job as an author to engage the reader, and I think that's every author's job. And if that isn't there, I would just...
Maybe it's the woman in me, but I'll give them 100 pages.
Oh, right, you're much kinder.
Well, 100 pages. I never read a book that was too short, but I read loads that were too long.
But
that is one of my things. Like, if I'm giving a class to people, I would often say that. I would often begin a conversation by saying that kind of thing, you know.
I think you're all very harsh.
Well,
I really work at it.
I'm giving them a bit more than that. I feel their pain.
Like somebody has put a year or 2 years or whatever.
In Hollywood, they say, you know, they talk about the hook on a film.
Yeah.
If you don't have the audience within 2-3 minutes, you're dead.
Yeah.
Right.
Especially with film where, you know, there's, you know, something happens.
So fast.
But my experience has been when something is really good, I know I get a taste in that first minute, that first 2 minutes, I go, oh, there's something happening here. There's something really happening here.
I think that's right too, I must say. I think, you know, right from the start, if the storytelling has authority, you know, if the person knows what they're doing, you kind of do get that pretty quickly.
Right. Okay, well, listen, we're going to have to leave it there on those harsh notes, but anyway, great books suggested. Totally agree with Joseph O'Connor's choice. I was about 60 when I read it, and I still loved every page. Catcher in the Rye, when Holden is crossing the road and repeats, "Don't let me disappear," always makes me cry spontaneously, and much more besides, it has to be said on the same subject. Listen, I've got to give out the answer to our competition. The winner is Helen Hanley in Galway. Greece is the Word was number one. Beauty School Dropout was number two. Grease Lightning was number three. That was easy peasy. Now, I want to say thanks to you all for joining us. Before we started, there were some spoilers ahead. Anyway, a back ref. Joseph, how's Shadow Playing going?
It's going very well. Thank you very much.
He picked that as another one of his.
Fantastic book.
Yes, brilliant. I agree.
Give yourself a 5-course meal of a book.
Okay. 7 Letters, yours, available now. And you're working on one about Monto, which I look forward to reading. Anyway, thank you all very, very much.
Thank you
for coming in.